Last year, Adam and I and a few hundred friends of DeSoto gathered in the Masonic Lodge inside a cemetery in the heart of Hollywood. Were we there to practice some dark rite? Some sinister ritual designed to bring deceased Star Trek actors back to the plane of the living? To bring an unholy horde of undead nerd celebrities to Earth to consume the brains of the living? No, we were just doing our live show of the Share Your Embarrassment Tour. It's our review of Star Trek V, and we filmed it. We just wanted to let you know to get ready for that live stream announcement coming next week. If you're a Max Fun member and you support our shows, you'll get access to discounted tickets from membership at MaximumFun.org. So, good time to make sure those emails are delivering properly to your inbox. Either way, we'll be announcing ticket links soon here and on our mailing list that you can sign up for at podshop.biz. The Share Your Embarrassment Tour is coming to your living room for one last stop, and you're not going to want to miss it.
Captain!
Not here.
Captain! Signatures detected.
Shields up.
Signatures detected.
Red alert.
Context Starfleet Command.
What's happening?
Context Starfleet Command.
Delay that order.
Context Starfleet Command.
This is the captain.
Context Starfleet Command.
Get out of my chair. Chair.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Welcome to The Greatest Discovery. It's a Star Trek Discovery podcast by the makers of The Greatest Generation. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica.
You know, Adam, we on our sister show, The Greatest Generation, spent a lot of time in the run-up to Discovery coming out lobbying for a position in the writer's room. Like the writing team of Ben and Adam getting to be in that writer's room was something we were really angling for. We were hoping there was somebody out there in the audience that, you know, had enough pull to say, like, hey, these guys are great. I mean, I don't know why anybody would think that, but but somehow they thought we were great and that we should be in the writer's room. And here at the second to last episode of season one, I'm sad to announce that it didn't happen for us.
Ben, after almost having finished season one of Star Trek Discovery, I can confidently say that there's no place where we belong less than what I believe is to be a pretty skilled place in that Star Trek Discovery writer's room. I think our brand of assholery would be most unwelcome there.
I think we would be the two dumbest guys in the room.
Yeah, no question.
But I think they're, like, in watching this episode especially, there was a position that really leapt out at me as something I think that would be really fun for us.
Uh-huh.
Which is hallway extra on Discovery. Season two is in production right now. Here's my pitch. They don't even have to pay to fly us to Toronto. We'll pay our own way. We'll put ourselves up. We'll find accommodations. We'll feed ourselves. But put us in a uniform. Give us a hallway to be walking down, like conferring over some information on an iPad, and then stop and look up when some like super intense announcement is going out over the ship PA.
That's the important distinction, Ben, right there, is that I want to be an announcement extra. Someone
right.
who is standing still, looking skyward, listening to the voice of the captain.
I want to do the concern face of like, oh my God, shit is getting real.
Do you want loaf or no loaf for this?
Oh, I want loaf. Give me all the loaf. I want to be in the fucking makeup chair for 6 hours minimum. Ben, I want to be one of those like background aliens that you're like, what the fuck even is this alien? Like they're in Starfleet, but we've never heard of them.
It seems impossible for this alien to do a job. There's so much loaf on this alien.
Is that an alien or is that Mickey from In the Night Kitchen?
Because I don't want our appearance to hit the budget, I will be the one who wears no loaf at all. I want everyone to see my dumb face. I want to have... Actually, the place that my appearance would hit the budget the most would be in hair gel. I want that nice future hair that's slicked back a little bit. I want to wear the uniform.
Yeah.
That's going to be my look.
I think we could both be, you know, you could be the human crewmate and I could be the loafy crewmate. And I think that would be a lot of fun for both of us.
It also seems like it's far more attainable in the way that you and I prefer. Like our wax wings melted on the idea of being in the writer's room, Ben. Let's aim a little lower.
But it's like, come on, like we know that they're listening. We know that Tilly and the USS Jaeger, et cetera, would not have happened if not for The Greatest Generation. Hopefully they're listening to The Greatest Discovery, and hopefully they've taken pity on these two idiots.
I'm pretty sure one of our listeners is a gaffer on the show. I keep getting intermittent tweets from someone who...
No kidding.
Who writes about being on the production, and yet, like, this person in their Twitter bio is not super specific about it in a way that I feel like is very intentional, and so I am not asking this person a bunch of questions about the show because I think that's, like, there's an embargo on what this person can say, but... You know, if we have people on the inside, I think that could be very beneficial to this campaign.
Yeah.
All campaigns need a hashtag, Ben. Do you have one for this?
God, what is it going to be?
Maybe it'll come to us as we record. I don't have anything off the top of my head, but...
Okay, well, maybe we need to get into the app to stir our creativity, shall we?
I'm with you, man. I love Toronto. I'd pay my own way. I'm a non-union actor. Just stick me in the background. Be cheap. Cheap and easy. Let's make it happen.
We'll donate our salaries to science education.
Fuck yeah, that's what we'll do. That's a great idea.
We're not in this for the money. We're in it for the loaf and the vindication that we don't deserve.
I'm also in it to be discovered, Ben. I want someone to see us in the background and go, those guys have it. I don't know what it is. But I'm going to ask that guy for a meeting and give him a bottle of water.
Mm-hmm.
Ben, let's go ahead and talk about the penultimate episode of the first season of Star Trek Discovery. It's season 1, episode 14, The War Without, The War Within.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons? Klingons? Those are Klingons?
What the hell is going on this ship?
The slightest idea.
In the episode before the last episode of any season, you sort of expect a lot of, like, you expect to see things tied up, but I think this episode starts more problems than it solves.
Yeah. Yeah, the last episode was doing a lot of bow tying, and this is doing a lot of adding new string to the pile.
Right.
And, so we start with, like, we see the paint job getting fixed on the outside of the ship, and Saru showing up in the transporter room to discover that that Georgiou is back, but but this Georgiou is looking to eat some Saru, and she raises her gun and almost shoots him, but Michael Burnham disarms her pretty quickly.
Kelpian is my captain.
Yeah, and Saru is not super happy about a mirror universe person being so familiar with his race, given that Michael Burnham told him that there were no Kelpians in the mirror universe. He sort of what the fucks her.
And it's worse than that. Like, he finds out that she ate one of his people.
Mm.
So awkward. Saru, like, has mirror Georgiou sent to quarters and confined there, and then tells the transporter chief, like, this is a big secret, don't tell anybody. And he's like, oh yeah, I just work in here, like, nobody talks to me. Michael Burnham is like, yeah man, like, I don't think I could watch her die again. Like, I've been through a lot, and that would have just been like another piece of trauma to inflict on myself.
I love that the transporter op in this room has, like, Justin Guarani hair. Like, everything that's out is back in again in the future.
His hair is beautiful, and I have definitely noticed it a few times. This is the first time I think he's spoken.
Yeah, and the idea to classify Mirror Universe Georgiou's presence is a thing that continues throughout the episode. This idea that we've got to squish knowledge of this mirror universe and keep it away from everyone who might be interested in it.
It's especially interesting because it kind of makes you think about like what everybody on the ship knows about and what they don't.
Yeah.
Like, was it only the people on the bridge that saw the hologram projection of Emperor Georgiou when that reveal happened? Sort of seems like it might be that way, right?
That's a great point. It's not like her appearance hasn't happened already before. I don't know how you keep a secret this big.
Everybody must have known that they were in a different universe because their whole ship needed to like work on the project of getting back to their own universe. But yeah, it seems like there's like a lot of layers of classification, and they're pretty confident that secrets are not getting out.
I feel like at some point, if the Federation is lucky enough to survive the war, there's going to be like an alien autopsy style show on Fox where like the painter of the ship that paints the eye to the U and then back to the eye again will be like shot in backlight, and his voice will be all modulated, and it'll be like, yeah, I helped paint the ship. We were in that mirror universe for a long time.
Oh, Kevin, you operate the little shuttlecraft that repaints the ship?
As a way to make some extra money, I offer my voice talents as a way to anonymize witnesses to the mirror universe.
As a man who lives outside of time, I know that this is still over 100 years before I meet my lovely wife, Rashan, and therefore I'm just biding my time among the humans until that happens.
Do you think Mirror Universe Kevin Uxbridge is a thing, or does Kevin Uxbridge exist in all universes? Because I could imagine Mirror Universe Kevin Uxbridge is like, instead of exterminating the Hooshnack, I decided I had no need for Rashan. Instead, I fucked all the Hooshnack everywhere.
We have no rubber to fit your penis.
This is a total scandal, and I'm really interested to see if they're able to cover this up. It seems like at many times throughout this episode, they make the case for the secrecy in a way that just doesn't seem plausible.
Yeah, it does feel like they are setting the table for why Spore Drive doesn't exist after this in the timeline.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a bit of a strained issue at this point. I love there's like a walk and talk between Saru and Michael Burnham, and they're like walking through the ship. The ship is taking some bangers, and so they're kind of patching it back up. And I loved the sound design of this walk and talk. Like we've talked about this a little bit before, like hearing the background of, announcements going out and people working and stuff. It feels so much like a real place. And I think that's a cool new thing for Trek.
The backgrounds are super deep on this show. I think they're deeper than any other Star Trek series.
Yeah.
And they fill the backgrounds with people and activity, and in this case, an angle grinder with sparks coming off of it. Like this feels like a lived-in place in a way that that TNG really wasn't. And you know, one of the differences between past Star Trek and future Star Trek is, I think, the carpeting, because you could never run an angle grinder on the Enterprise D, because those sparks are going to light the carpet on fire.
Yeah.
You think Ash Tyler gets some PTSD walking through those halls and an angle grinder is brandished? I probably would.
He needs a trigger warning before he sees an angle grinder.
So the core of the conversation between Burnham and Saru is the presence of Georgiou and why she thought to take her. And at this point, it's a little bit ambiguous. But Saru is not against the idea of her existing in this universe.
Yeah, he basically says, like, we'll see whether or not this was a terrible judgment call, but
right.
I'm not gonna call it yet.
He reserves judgment and then pivots into, hey, also, you remember your boy? We did some power glove on his brains, and he seems to be recovering, so maybe you'd like to see him?
And Burnham is not thrilled by that idea. She even goes to so far as to say, like, are you ordering me to go talk to him? Because if not, I'm not down. And man, like, what a bummer. Like, she's been through so much, and she comes back and, like, you know, like, what would normally be the person you want to, like, run back into the arms of, like, the last time she interacted with him, he tried to choke her out.
Yeah, it's a lot to get over, and her disinterest in seeing him again is totally understandable, I think, at this point.
Yeah, her arc in this episode is really interesting and very emotionally tough, I think.
Yeah. Saru is able to absolve Ash of the crimes that his body has committed, at least.
Right, yeah. Like, anything that was a Voke act is... it. Like, Saru can really easily categorize that as not Ash Tyler's fault.
It's because Saru is like, yeah, I was under the sway of a Kool-Aid sneeze not too long ago, and everyone forgave me, so I guess I'm just going to pay it forward.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. It's really great that we live in a time when we can disentangle alien influence from our own actions. It's awesome.
No kidding. Jeez. But that doesn't stop them from putting him under a form of house arrest. They fit him for a bracelet. And
yeah.
Did you notice how uniquely Saru is walking in this episode, even compared to previous episodes? I think before we've noticed that he's sort of walking on the fronts of it, on the toes of his feet. He's wearing the hoof boots. This is right. The first time I've noticed that for balance, he's like, his hands are behind his back and he sort of sways his arms as yeah. he walks down a hallway. It's really elegant, and it's a really interesting alien detail from him, from Doug Jones.
He kind of walks like John Roderick. This is a long cold open.
Yeah.
Ash Tyler is given a, you know, like a limited amount of freedom. He's not going back to work. He's been stripped of rank, but he can walk around and do his thing. He's going to, like, do the work of trying to figure out what his life looks like from here on in, and takes the news that Michael Burnham is back, but also the, like, unstated thing that she is not, you know, desperate to see him. Pretty tough.
His life looks incredibly bleak right now. I mean, he doesn't have a home. He doesn't have an identity, which is worse. Everyone he loved before now hates him for totally rational reasons. It's not the sort of pain that comes from people not understanding you and hating you for the wrong reasons. Like, in this case, they're right.
He's kind of two people in one, but with only the motivations of the one at this point. And I feel like that is as close as we are probably going to get to having a detailed explanation of what the Klingons did to him.
Yeah, I mean, they seem really uninterested in being ultra-specific about it. And I guess maybe it might not matter at this point. This is about Ash's recovery. And maybe we're not looking back anymore if we're Ash.
Yeah. So Saru heads up to the bridge, and they're detecting that a Starfleet ship might be nearby. Like, they've been having a tough time raising the rest of the Starfleet universe, but onto the bridge beams an invasion force of Starfleets, and it is like every alien in the Starfleet handbag, and among them is Admiral Bob and Sarek. And Sarek basically walks up and steals all of Saru's memory, and like over Michael Burnham's protest.
You rarely see an assault meld in Star Trek. This is a fairly rare thing.
It is like almost as surprising and fucked up as the end of Undiscovered Country.
Right.
Unlike that scene, Saru, like, you know, relents and lets it happen. And Sarek basically, like, goes ashen and turns to Admiral Bob and is like, man, these guys have been through some shit.
What's great about a mind meld is that it's a super efficient way to catch people up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's basically a smash cut into a McLaughlin group.
Issue one.
Where they go around the table discussing where they're at right now. Admiral Bob is apoplectic about Lorca and feels a little bit, I think, disappointed that he's dead instead of giving her the chance to adjudicate what he's done. She feels bad that she wasn't able to recognize him for the mirror universe person that he was also. Like, there's a bunch of competing feelings.
Well, they also do this weird thing where she's like, oh, well, there's no way that my Lorca could have survived in the mirror universe because it's too crazy there. So he's probably dead. And they just kind of leave it at that. Like, I wouldn't expect them to be mounting a rescue operation for Lorca, but I also feel like there's like a little bit of weird convenience in just deciding he must be dead because we haven't heard from him.
Well, what this set me up into thinking was that Admiral Bob is at every turn interested in squishing and classifying Mirror Universe stuff.
Yeah.
Was Mirror Universe Discovery really destroyed, or is that just something that she told the crew? Like, because the Federation policy at this point seems to be about burying the evidence of that. And, I mean, if Prime Universe Lorca is over in the Mirror Universe and the Defiant is still there, like, is Prime Universe Lorca truly dead? And in this show especially, is anyone really dead if we don't see them die?
Yeah, I'm thinking that it could be setting him up to come back and waste Giorgio.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, if you think about, like, a season two where Michael Burnham has been given some sort of, you know, judicial reprieve and recommissioned as an officer, but she has to serve under Lorca, who is a version of Lorca that she doesn't really know, right, and also, like, avenged himself to Emperor Giorgio and re-killed her, you know, her mother figure in front of her again. Like, that is a complicated-ass relationship.
Yeah, it's a Mobius strip of story right there is what you're describing.
Yeah, it might almost be too, like, high concept for a character relationship, but I don't know. It's fun to think about.
It's hard to accuse the show of being too high concept when one of its main storylines is, like, they basically unzipped, they made a skin suit out of Ash Tyler and then, like, minimized Voke and stuck him in there.
We have been waiting for someone worthy of our attention.
What? Who are you?
So one of the things that they disclose in this McLaughlin group is that the Klingons aren't working as one group collective. All of the 24 houses have fractured, and they're all trying to score points on the Federation in order to come out on top as, like, top house. Like, if in a CBS reality show parlance, like, like, this is the reality show that they're doing. Like, whose house is going to come out on top? And it's really bloody because all of the Klingons are better than all of the Federation, and they really can't do anything to stop this kind of bloodshed.
And they've been doing bad stuff, like crazy stuff, stuff that is unthinkable, but also, like, doesn't even have any strategic value, just like killing 11,000 civilians that aren't even a part of the conflict just to get some points on the board. It's like the kind of mayhem that you can't defend against because you can never predict what the next thing is going to be.
Yeah. So Admiral Bob is like, look, Disco is probably still the most valuable tool in the fleet. We got to get her back to Starbase One. We got to share this intel. And then we've also got to destroy this intel.
Yeah. They've distributed the detect cloaking field math that they did to the rest of the fleet. But They don't want that to be too little too late.
And the case that they make in the room is fairly fascinating for its expungement. They are like, look, if people in our universe find out that their loved ones are alive in a different universe, the desperation of those people could be a real problem for us. So
this knowledge must be buried.
In the next scene, Admiral Bob actually meets Emperor Giorgio with Sarek and Michael Burnham. Ben, all of the quarters on this ship are giant. Like, for someone who is supposed to be in sort of, like, neutral brig, like, not punishment brig, she's just in sort of a place where they can hold her, Really yeah. Nicely appointed cabin.
She checked in at Engine Hospitality's desk, and he found out that she had Starwood Platinum status. So he's like, oh, looks like we can upgrade you.
Looks like you're an emperor. We're going to go ahead and give you the penthouse. And it totally has like booze in it.
Yeah. Michael Burnham says something pretty weird here, which is that... that Giorgio, you know, has been deposed from her empire and deserves political asylum. Why does she deserve anything? She's like mirror universe Hitler. She's a horrible person. We saw her destroy a planet because people who disagree with her were on it.
Yeah, this show has a fairly short memory. Like, also, correct me if I'm wrong, but like, can you only claim asylum for yourself?
I don't really know how it works. I mean... It seems like they're willing to keep her around and they see her as having potential value, but it's really fun because they're so Starfleet-y and she is so haughty and imperial around them. You know, she like walks yeah. around the room like she owns the place, and it's a really cool performance on Michelle Yeoh's part. Like the way she feels totally different and totally regal in front of these people that it's meaningless to.
I know that she is dead, and I am not.
Her imprisonment does not diminish her danger in any way. She yeah. is like a coiled snake.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons? Klingons? Those are Klingons?
What the hell is going on this ship?
I have no idea.
What is this?
There's a really fun pivot in terms of tone after this scene, right? You get the confidence of an Emperor Georgiou, and then you cut immediately to Ash Tyler kind of skulking his way through a corridor when he runs into Stamets. Like, if we're talking about differences in confidence, I don't think Ash Tyler could be any lower. And Stamets really rightfully and yet professionally lays into him. Like, he doesn't raise his voice to Ash. He doesn't try to punch him in the face.
It's a very brief interaction. It's, yeah. I mean, it's almost surprisingly brief given how much time we've spent on it. But I think Stamets really intrinsically understands what happened. And yeah. while he's not forgiving it, he's also like a kind of character that doesn't see the point in like drawing anything out.
I also wondered if you plugged yourself into the size of the universe and understood the scale of it in the way that Stamets does, is your grief over the love for one person diminished, like in such a way that like you feel it and you're able to express it?
Right.
And the way that Stamets does it is like, you killed someone I loved who was very special to me. But if your world grows as big as it is for him, I wonder what that does to your relative ability to process the grief over someone.
Right.
It seems to me like it can't help but diminish that in an interesting way.
Stamets and Burnham have the most to resent in Ash Tyler. And
yeah.
they, you know, I don't think Stamets wanted to talk to Ash Tyler either. It's just that they yeah. run into each other. Like, you kind of see it in his body language. The like, oh, crap, now I have to talk to this guy.
Did you ever avoid a bully in junior high? I did. And I got to tell you, like, I would have been far more careful if I were Ash Tyler about the place where I might have run into this guy. Like, there is no way I would allow meeting Stamets in the hallway to happen if I were Ash Tyler.
Yeah. Ash Tyler's next scene is going to the mess hall, and it's a really surprising and beautiful moment of humanity where he sits down by himself and Tilly like sees him and just like quickly gets up and goes over to him, and he's like, no, like you don't have to like try and be friendly to me, I'm fine. And she says,
how could that possibly be true?
Yeah, this was a really beautiful scene, Ben. Like, I don't know how you could love Tilly any more than
yeah.
right now. She's just the greatest. It made me think a lot about how this series is so different from other Star Trek series and how it depicts the other, whether mm-hmm. or not you're the other alien or you're the other personality or you're the other or whether you're like the person who's taken an action that other people find terrible. You know, like, I think for as long as we've been watching Star Trek, Starfleet is an organization that carries itself as the best of what humanity offers.
Yeah.
And there's so many people in this show that aren't the best. There are almost more non-best people on this show than like best and brightest Federation people. And
well, we don't really know that many of the bridge crew. Maybe they're like totally the best, but we just don't know it.
I thought a lot about TNG and how the others, as depicted on that show, were sort of made fun of. And this show doesn't make fun of Tilly in the way that, you know, ditzy Sonia Gomez was made fun of, or Barclay, or Nog, or Loxana.
Or Data, even? Like,
yeah, like anyone who doesn't fit the mold of that smart, serious, socially aware, cocksure main character.
Yeah.
Like, and that's something that I've come around to by watching Discovery, is like TNG made fun of those characters, and they made fun of you if you were like them. And Discovery doesn't. Discovery embraces you if you're different. And Tilly is the example of the person who does. And I think that's really beautiful.
I do too. Michael Burnham is different from everybody. And I keep coming back to just how amazing the performance is. Like how many like different versions of Michael Burnham we have seen, you know, like the I am living on Vulcan and acting hella Vulcan all the time Michael Burnham, to total meltdown mode Michael Burnham, to putting her life back together Michael Burnham, and like how big the subtle changes are. They're small in the performance, but what they mean is really big. And it's amazing. Like, she's like the one person that has the biggest problem with Michael Burnham is Saru. And the show sets up Saru as being kind of an asshole for having that problem, you know?
Right. I mean, but he's also set up as the most infirm in mentality and physicality.
Yeah. And like, yet he's really come into his own. Like, I felt like the show felt really Star Trek-y the second he started being captain.
Yeah.
Like, it started feeling like, oh man, like this is like a Star Trek ship in a way that we recognize, in a way that it wasn't under Lorca. Like, it felt weird under Lorca.
Right.
And that was just a tone thing and a subtle tone thing, but they really did something cool with that.
Yeah, tone is the hardest part of any show to dial in. And this show naturally found its level in the contrast between those two characters as captain. You're right.
Well, speaking of Saru, they head to Starbase One, and they're just about to drop out of warp when Saru dumps them out and shows them ganglia. The image resolves on the screen, and it's Starbase One with a cloud of wreckage around it and like the burning body of a starship floating nearby, and it's been tagged up. This has turned into a bad neighborhood. This neighborhood's really gone south.
Admiral Bob, like, is so far from the cocksure admiral that boarded the ship in the beginning of the episode. Yeah. She actually kind of goes catatonic here at what she's seeing, because she's seeing, you know, unlike the depictions of loss that were shown in the McLaughlin group earlier, where it's just four-digit thousands of dead per skirmish, like 80,000 people died when Starbase One was destroyed, and three more ships, and bunch of the Starfleet executive branch too. And like that this was totally a surprise is something that just totally stuns her. And Saru actually orders the ship away because Admiral Bob is so frozen by this moment, which I thought was a great command decision by Saru at this point. He's able to step in and make a decision to save the ship.
I wish they had said what Starbase One was in orbit of, because they said it's 100 AUs from Earth, which means it's really quite like it's 100 times as far from Earth as Earth is from the sun. But it's in orbit of a planet that has clouds, so it's like it's within our solar system. Like, what is that? Europa or something?
It's weird. I don't know.
No. I wish they had said, you know, like it I feel like it wouldn't have been that hard to say.
On TNG, they would have gone around the horn like Sector 001 and then cut to another character. You mean Starbase 1? Cut to another character. You mean Earth?
But it's not Earth.
Yeah, yeah.
It couldn't be, or if it is, they got their math wrong.
Yeah, the significance of it is in the loss of life. At this point, it is not necessarily geographical.
The safety of Starbase One doesn't exist anymore, and Admiral Bob marches down to the brig and confronts Laurel, and kind of fills Laurel in on what has happened in a way that Laurel hasn't heard about before. But it's like she's really taking apart the T'Kuvma ideology in doing this. She's like, yeah, like T'Kuvma didn't know what the fuck he was talking about when he said that Starfleet wanted to assimilate the Klingons. Like, we don't. We're not interested in it. Like, the main rule that we all follow is not getting up in other cultures' businesses unless they want. But this war is not the united Klingon Empire that you were fighting for. And all it is Klingons killing humans and civilians and stuff for points. And it's destroying my civilization, and it's the opposite of what T'Kuvma put into the world.
I think there's three or four scenes of monologuing in this episode, and they're all really strong. But this one might be one of my favorites because Admiral Bob really lays out in practical terms what she's going for here. Like, she just drops the rank. The wall to the brig might as well not even be up. She's like, negotiate with me. What does your side even want? Like, are there terms to this war? If so, what are they? And Laurel, in a hyper-efficient manner, basically says the war serves itself. Like, once you've started this thing with us, it does not end. And that is a terrifying thought.
They're going to either finish you off or you're going to finish them off. There's no, like, middle thing.
This isn't like any other war they've ever fought. And I think Bob may be willing to surrender some stuff in order to make it end. I don't think she sees an outcome to the war in which the Federation survives.
It's the Borg's problem, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
The Federation wants to, like, they want to do diplomacy. They want to reach an understanding, and they're facing an enemy that has zero interest in that and is operating on a totally different rule book.
Yeah. Random thought about this scene, Ben, is I really like seeing Admiral Bob with the unzipped uniform top, a lot like the original series era film look. I like that that's still a thing.
Yeah. Another random thought, in the prison garb that they've given her, Laurel looks like a real marshmallow head because she's got so much loaf up top and like a pretty slight frame underneath.
Yeah. Party on the top. No business anywhere else. It's just all party.
Head to the penthouse for the party.
Feels like this episode is a lot of people seeing other people and having conversations with them. You know?
Yeah.
That's not a complaint, though.
No. The next one is Michael Burnham and Emperor Georgiou talking about, like, what is it going to take to beat these Klingons? And Georgiou has a theory of fighting the Klingons.
The Klingons are like cancer cells, constantly dividing. To root them out, you must destroy the tumor at its source.
Georgiou puts this idea into Burnham's head, and she takes it to Bob, and it's pretty soon like what they are doing, which is, we are going to go take the fight to the Klingons. We're going to do a coordinated assault on Kronos that... which is like not something that the rest of the Starfleet brass is up for. Like the argument is that, like, oh, we need to go back and defend Earth. And Admiral Bob is like, hey, listen, our tactics have shown a solid 9 months of absolute failure. So why don't we start thinking a little outside the box, or rather a little inside the Kronos?
This is another moment that feels a lot like Best of Both Worlds too, in that, you know, if if what you've tried before has failed, you must try a thing you'd never think of doing before. And this is an idea that the Federation hasn't considered because they haven't been to Kronos in 100 years, and they have no idea where the furniture is situated on that planet.
Right.
It's got an atmosphere that you can't see through. It's got defenses that they don't know about. It's super far away. It seems like a suicide mission in a lot of ways.
Yeah, so the idea is they're going to get some more spores and jump Discovery to the interior of Kronos and then use like a drone to map the orbital defenses and all the like military targets and then take them out from there. And we kind of split into two plot lines at this point. The one plot line is Stamets and Tilly, etc., like mounting a terraform a planet very quickly with spore fungus so that we can get a whole bunch of spores because we're out on the one hand, and like the machinations of Giorgio on the other hand. She's like, hey, listen, like I've given you like a strategic leg up here, but it's not going to be enough, and I can actually guarantee success if you work with me on this. She's talking to Sarek, and he's willing to trust her in a surprising way, and I guess it might be because of the mind meld. Like, I guess he maybe knows, like, because he mind melded with Saru, like, what this Giorgio's capabilities are.
If your survival depended on trusting her, wouldn't you have to meld her, too?
Yeah, or, like, wouldn't you just meld her to get what you needed strategically and tactically out of her and then do it yourself?
To me, Emperor Giorgio already stated her goal. She wants to get back to the Mirror Universe, and everything that follows this moment seems to me as she's Lorca-ing. She's going to try to get back, and if it means being the captain of the Discovery, just like Lorca was, like this feels like that kind of plan to her.
Like, give her the chair, but like put a piece of lucite over the little computer on the handlebar of the chair so that she doesn't mess up a jump.
The existential question that this moment raises and the episode raises is, what are you willing to do to ensure your survival? There are a bunch of times when people talk about using mirror universe methods in the Prime Universe, and there's a bunch of argument about, like, that's not us. We don't do that shit. But when the survival of your species is at stake, you have to be willing to do awful shit, right?
This is Star Trek hashing out a thing that they've hashed out a million times. Like, there's best of both worlds in this. There's that, I can't remember what it's called, there's that TNG episode where they're like down on some planet and the doctor gets abducted in a terrorist attack.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a like utopian socialist society that is interacting with other societies that are unpersuaded by their values and willing to do horrible things to them, and like trying to wrap their minds around how you project yourself into a galaxy that doesn't necessarily agree with everything you're doing, even though you like are really convicted in the things you're doing being the right thing.
What?
What's happening?
What?
No. What's all this?
I'm trying to save you.
What is this?
Michael Burnham has a conversation with Sarek, and he's like, hey, I gotta go. Like, there's some, you know, this plan is off to a great start, but there's some stuff I gotta go look into. Hey, by the way, just before I go, W/R/T, Ash Tyler, like, you shouldn't feel bad for having loved him. And, you know, love thine enemy is a pretty cool and groovy way to live. So, peace out.
James Frain, in playing Sarek here, does some really subtle stuff. When he turns away from Michael Burnham here, there's a stilt in his turn. I don't know if you've got this scene queued up, but when he turns away to go to the transporter room, there's his full turn back around when he expresses his feelings about loving the enemy. But before he does that, there's a little stutter in him. You can see how torn he is about leaving her in a really subtle way, in a way that I don't know that you direct. I think that's just coming from him. And I think it's just a really amazing acting job by James Frain here.
Yeah, he's really terrific. I think that the performances on this show have been fairly universally great.
Yeah.
He says something about how, like, she's like embarrassed to have let emotions get the better of her. And he says, "You're human, as is your mother." And I wondered if you thought he was talking about Giorgio or about his wife.
I thought at the time he was talking about his wife. And I think it serves to underscore why he is such a different Vulcan, because he loves humans. He loves his wife as he loves Michael Burnham.
Yeah.
He understands how difficult it is to love someone who is different from yourself in the way that Michael Burnham is now confronting in her own life.
Yeah. And I think that, like, this conversation really hits her with a double whammy of, like, A, this kind of felt like I was saying goodbye to Sarek forever, and B, he's really, like, bringing into relief the pain that I feel over Ash Tyler. And I think she kind of tries to run from it. Like, she's going down to engineering to talk to Tilly about, you know, how, you know, the spore planting project is coming. And then she kind of breaks and says, like, "Hey, man, like, I just talked to my dad and he left and I am feeling shitty." And Tilly is like, is there for her emotionally, but it's also like, "Hey, you need to also go talk to your boyfriend, because you have been avoiding him and that is not cool."
I really like that this scene exists because it's another great Tilly moment, but it also means that Michael Burnham is getting it from all sides about her need to confront Ash about what happened.
Right.
It's not just her father figure that does it. It's her best friend on the ship too. Like, there's really no quarter for her anymore where she's not getting this kind of advice. So she has to do it.
Yeah, and she finds Tyler having a Star Trek approved window bum out. He's in, like, this room full of, like, scuba tanks for some reason.
Well, here's the headcanon I had, Ben. This to me seemed like the set where you get dressed to go out of the airlock and do spacewalks.
Oh, you think he was going to go do, he was going to space himself?
That's what I thought. We've seen so many people die in unexposed space on this show. I thought maybe the implication was that he was considering killing himself.
Wow. Yeah, this is an intense scene. Like, she comes in and he takes a step toward her and she steps back.
Yeah.
And they have a tough conversation here. He's saying, like, you know, like, he has no illusion that she's going to just accept him back, you know, unconditionally or whatever. It's not going to be the way it was with Tilly. You know, like Michael Burnham and Stamets have hurt from the things that Voke in Ash did. And this scene is about Michael Burnham confessing to him that she is not stronger than that hurt. Like, she cannot look at him without thinking about the pain of it.
I really like how this scene was written too. There's some efficiency in her dialogue when she states,
"You said that if it got to be too much, that if you couldn't handle it, you would come to me. And it did. And you did."
Well, it's like, to whatever extent Ash Tyler is culpable for what happened, it is in that he didn't get help. And
right.
He didn't trust his loved ones enough to help him when he needed it.
And that's another major theme of the show, is that, you know, these characters share as a way to get over things or feel things or celebrate things. Ash is fucking ridiculous in this scene, though, as far as the case that he's trying to make. Like, he's terribly hurt, and that's understandable, but he's not feeling a great amount of empathy for Michael Burnham's position, because he actually, like, he's like, "You just want to leave because things got complicated." That is selling it so short.
Yeah.
And to actually need Michael Burnham to illustrate that it's not just complicated, you tried to kill me, and here's exactly how that felt when you did, was was tough. Like, I think Ash needs to know himself a little better in this moment, too.
Yeah. This ain't high school, Ash Tyler.
Right.
The way the scene ends is really interesting because she's like, hey, I've been going through the process of putting myself back together after losing it all as well. And it's a solitary and painful process. And the kind of unsaid thing that is very evident in that is like, I am not going to be here to help you. And you kind of see it on his face, like the question of like, why can't we help each other with it? You know, right. Like, why can't we put things back together together? Like, you totally understand where she's coming from. Like, how do you ever trust a guy again after he's very intentionally tried to kill you? And like, you saw it in his face, like the,
well, Ben, I would point to hundreds of years of domestic abuse as examples of why people stay in relationships that are abusive, you know?
And also why people leave them.
Right. Yeah.
And the freight of that is like totally in this scene. It's very, I kind of think it like explains why he kind of goes into a few irrational places with arguing for her to stay. That kind of felt realistic to that.
There's a beautiful part in the case that Ash is making here in that he says non-specifically that love was the reason that the program didn't activate in his brain all the way. Like, his love for her was the reason that he's not a fully realized Klingon sleeper agent that's in a cell or dead at the moment. And I like the idea of that.
Yeah. I wanted to talk about light in this scene.
Yeah.
Because it is by far the most brightly lit we've seen either of these characters, but it kind of flips a couple of times. Like, when she comes in, he's backlit and very dark, and he like approaches her and they like kind of switch around, like they trade spaces, and then he is super brightly lit. And when they have that like unfiltered sunlight on them, they look very naked and exposed, and it's very evocative of what their characters are going through at the time. And then like when the shadows fall on them, it always coincides with when they are closing themselves off to each other.
Right. That intentionality is demonstrated throughout the episode. I think another example of that is that scene with Tilly and Michael Burnham in engineering that's all handheld.
Yeah.
Like, the stress that Michael's going through, like, handheld is a technique that shows people under stress. And that entire scene is really moving around hard in a way that helps underscore that. In the same way that in this scene, there's sort of a pastel cast from the planet below. The scene that happens below this scene is when the Disco dumps their agribusiness all over the Veda Moon and starts growing spores there. And I think, you know, the life below the ship during this conversation gives everything this interesting lighting, and it's a great contrast to the death of a relationship that's happening in that room. Like, I think Michael even says so, like, we're watching something beautiful happen and something is dying inside both of us at this moment.
Yeah. She walks out and says to Ash Tyler that this is not easy for her. It's very heartfelt, you know, like breaking up with somebody because you need to, and not because you don't love them, but because it's not the right thing for you right now, is a hard thing to do. And it takes a lot of inner strength to do it. And like, she knows that she's hurting him in this moment, but she's also like doing an act of self-preservation.
Yeah, I agree. And there's no equivocation here either. It feels like the decision has been made, and she turns and walks away.
She is not leaving the door open.
Yeah, yeah, in that the door literally closes behind her.
So Admiral Bob walks out onto the bridge, and she makes a little speech to the whole ship that rewrites history a lot. There are about 10 dozen hallway extras, you and myself not included, who look up at the speakers and find out that Captain Philippa Georgiou was not in fact killed, but was rescued from Klingons and was brought aboard with Admiral Bob's retinue. And now she is going to take command of the Starship Discovery to go bring the fight to the Klingons.
Ben, do you think the bridge crew has any doubt about her identity, being that they've all seen Emperor Georgiou in the Mirror Universe? They don't take the story at face, do they?
No, they definitely don't. But I think that, like, the implication is that if you work on the lower decks, you're not aware of this situation. So, like, if you're there in the room hearing this, you're like, okay, this is the story and we're sticking to it. And if you're not in the room, you're going like, holy shit, there's been a lot going on up there. I thought that it would have been interesting to have the McLaughlin group where Admiral Bob lays out this idea to everybody.
Yeah, and they do that, and then they cross-cut to Georgiou in her quarters, putting on the disco uniform and, like, tying her hair into the efficient ponytail and, like, unscowling herself. I would have liked that scene.
Yeah. But, yeah, Saru and Burnham take their seats and get ready to go fight, and that's the end of the episode.
And Georgiou kind of big dogs Burnham, like, right away. Like, you think we were going to get along? Person who thought she killed me before?
Hello. Allow me to reintroduce myself. My name is Captain Philippa Hitler Georgiou.
Do you think installing her as the captain is being done not just because of her knowledge of Kronos, but, like, does it absolve Starfleet from what they know is going to be done? Like, she is going to go Hitler on Kronos. They know how savage she is. Like,
she's going to Vulcan goodbye them.
Setting aside the idea, the question of how can they possibly trust this person to lead them? Like, I sort of feel like she provides effective cover for an atrocity to come.
Yeah, effective cover and also, like, the willingness to do it that none of them have.
Yeah.
We're not atrocity people here in Prime Universe.
It's fucking weird for an admiral to give the ship to someone else, especially for it to be given to Georgiou here. That felt off to me, but we'll see why in the next episode.
Yeah. Did you like this episode, Adam?
I really liked the episode, Ben. It was, I made a comment earlier that sounded disparaging, and that it was a lot of people going to meet other people to talk about what had happened and what was going to happen. But this episode is so much more than that description, because all of those conversations are super weighty, and the stakes are so high. I really liked, I liked that moment with Ash and Stamets in the hallway. I really liked everything that Tilly did this episode. Tilly was given basically two scenes, and she hit dingers on both of them.
Yeah.
For all the reasons that we discussed, I think this is one of the strongest episodes of the season. What about you?
Yeah, I like that too. I mean, it's a weird episode in that, like, not a ton happens externally. It's mostly just about kind of, like, people sorting out their feelings about what has transpired so far. Like, it is almost shocking to think that we only have 45 minutes of show left. And I'm almost expecting the next episode to be extra long. I mean, this one was a little longer than normal at 49 minutes. So,
right.
Maybe we will get a double or something like that. But it seems like all of the stuff between Michael Burnham and Tyler is almost the denouement that you would expect in a final episode of an arc like this. So it's pretty interesting that it's happening where it's happening in the run.
I will say, I think your enjoyment of the episode is predicated on accepting the reasoning for Admiral Bob installing Georgiou as captain. If you can't accept that idea, and I understand how difficult it is to accept it, then I think the whole episode falls apart and doesn't make sense, and it makes it easily hateable.
Yeah.
I'm betting on the idea that some sense is made of that is revealed in the season finale.
Yeah, when you write a series like this, they talk about breaking the story, like figuring out how all the beats are going to go and, mm-hmm. and like what the meaning is behind the story and stuff in the writer's room. And I think that there have been several times where it has seemed like the story was not that well thought out, but then explained itself later in a way that was like surprising and satisfying. So it would be pretty disappointing if they didn't figure out a way for this to really be meaningful and good right at the finish line.
Right.
But, you know, remains to be seen. Yeah, I like the episode too. I agree with what you're saying. And it feels like a really big episode for Burnham and it really, like, you know, and Ash Tyler as well. Like, I really, I wonder what the future of that character is, because, I mean, they both sort of have the same fate, right? Like, once this adventure is over, they're both sort of scheduled for either prison or maybe even a science lab in Ash Tyler's case. And that that feels like a thing that can be overcome in story, but they haven't overcome it yet, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I'm really pumped for the finale. I mean, there were so many doubts about this show a year ago and before the premiere that, you know, initially I just felt relief that we were getting good Trek, and now I think relief has given way to great optimism about what's to come. And I really hope that I'm not eating those words after the season finale, because so often, you know, a finale is what either pays off the season before it or totally wrecks it.
Right.
And I think this is something that you've seen in television the last 10 years, especially. Yep. So hopefully Indeed. This show is able to realize all of its significant investment up until now.
Well, Adam, do you want to check our priority one inbox?
Yeah, there are some viewers who have invested in us through the use of a priority one message.
Priority one message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Adam, we have a P1 from the warm honeyed bosom, and it's for us. It's for Ben and Adam. It goes like this. P5, Janet Jackson killed the groundhog. Wart and Willie ruining Cardassian rodentide. Let's see the Ocean's 11 remake, 11 Cheetles, starring 10 Don Cheetles and Don in a binturong suit.
I'd watch a film with 10 Don Cheetles. Love that guy.
Yeah. Do you know how to work tenor gif magic? Your pumpkin technique leads to breakage. Try grapefruit instead. May your gait be stable and all your bones be covered. I feel like there's some kind of binturong continuity that we're not aware of.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
A lot of these priority one messages on this show, and I feel like also on The Greatest Generation, contain binturong gags.
You don't often want to change from cantaloupe to grapefruit, regardless of the context.
Yeah. No matter how many Don Cheadles we're talking about.
Yeah, those grapefruits sting.
Well, if you would like to leave a priority one message, you can do that by going to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. It's $100 for a personal message and $200 for a commercial message, and they help us fund the production of this program.
We do an embarrassing Star Trek podcast, and a big part of our success is owning that, being ourselves in all our embarrassing glory. But what if we didn't? What if we were just a Star Trek podcast? No embarrassment, no comedy, just Star Trek podcast. If you're somebody who wants a website, you could go generic and bland and one size fits all on a social media platform, or you could buy a custom URL and design a custom website with Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one platform for all kinds of people to stand out and succeed online. Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms. So whoever you are, or whatever you're trying to do, own it with Squarespace. Go to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/trek to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
It's Webby season. Hi, I'm Sequoia Holmes, host of the Black People Love Paramore podcast. And we are nominated for a Webby for the episode where I interviewed Hayley Williams. In case you're unfamiliar, Black People Love Paramore is a podcast delving into the common and uncommon interests of Black people in order to help us feel more seen. We would love your vote to help us win this Webby. Please take a second, go over to the Black People Love Paramore podcast social media accounts, and you can find them at BPLP Pod across all social media platforms. Hit the link in bio and vote for Black People Love Paramore.
Hi, I'm Travis McElroy.
And I'm Teresa McElroy.
And we're the host of Schmanners.
We don't believe that etiquette should be used to judge other people.
No, on Schmanners, we see etiquette as a way to navigate social situations with confidence.
So if that sounds like something you're into,
join us every Friday on Maximum Fun, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Ben.
What's that, Adam?
Did you find yourself a drunk Shimoda?
Incredible!
Drunk Shimoda!
Oh, I did, Adam. Gotta give it to Admiral Bob for phasering Lorca's cookies. It was a laugh out loud moment for me. And
I love that her phaser was set to campfire too.
Talk about the like totemic symbol of Lorca and taking out all of your frustration on it. A lot of fun and very Shimoda like in my opinion. How about yourself?
Yeah, I've got to give it to Bob too. She phasers the fortune cookies. She panics at Starbase One, and then she installs Georgiou as captain. I think all three of those incidents really add up to sort of an unhinged Bob at this point.
Well, it seems like it was Sarek that brought the idea of giving Georgiou a command to the brass, but it is Admiral Bob that is implementing it in that scene. So it's like, yeah. Shouldn't you raise some concerns about this course of action?
Seems like Georgiou would make a better special advisor to the captain than captain herself.
Yeah, give her one of the anklets that Ash Tyler is wearing and confine her movements around the ship. She is dangerous AF.
You know what's weird about this episode is we don't go into the ready room on the disco at all. I wonder if they're going to use it anymore. Like that is such an emblematic, like that was Lorca's throne.
Well, they shoot the standing the cookies. Isn't that in the,
that was in the McLaughlin group. They were in the, they were in the round in there.
Wow. How do phasers work that you can like dial in, just vaporize the bowl of cookies, but nothing around the bowl of cookies?
It's the you can phaser the pot that the mashed potatoes are in, but not the potatoes themselves.
Yeah.
It's the same
canonical
setting.
Phaser.
Yeah. Nicely done. We'll call back those potatoes anytime we can. Well, what do we have coming up on the next episode, Ben?
Well, we saw some action. We saw a lot of Klingon ships. We saw what looked to be the surface of Kronos. We saw maybe like a strip club environment.
Yeah.
It looked like it had human strippers in it.
We see Georgiou punching Laurel in the face and doing some Star Trek fighting.
Yeah. And like an argument between Michael Burnham and Admiral Bob about how we don't have the luxury of principle, and Michael Burnham writing for principle is all we have.
Oh, man. I'm pumped.
I'm pumped, too. Should we talk a little bit about the future of The Greatest Discovery while we're here?
Sure. Why not? I think we've decided off mic to continue the show into a second season, first of all. I think that's big news.
Yeah. So The Greatest Discovery is going to continue, and we will do a full season about season 2 of Star Trek Discovery. I think in the off season, we're going to go to a more relaxed show release pace of like once a month, and we'll try and follow like news and updates. But I don't know. Like I hope we can get some interviews with folks that worked on the show. Maybe talk to some other people that have been observers of the show and get their take. So
talk to extras casting specifically.
Yeah. We will continue the campaign to get ourselves cast as hallway extras.
We got to get a headshot, Ben. Do you have a headshot? I feel like we need those first and foremost.
Yeah. Should I have Loaf in the headshot, or do I leave that to them?
You know what we should do is like we should make our own Loaf for the headshots.
I do have this crazy mustache right now, and I feel like I've never seen a crew member of a Star Trek ship with a mustache. Maybe I can blaze that trail.
Yeah, it feels like Starfleet is a real Marge Schott-led environment, like with a strict no facial hair policy.
Yeah, come on, let's open it up.
That would be great. Yeah, I'm excited to do some off-season episodes where we just sort of dish on news that we read about the show and maybe talk to some interesting people. I think that will more than tide us over for a season two of the Disco Show.
So stay subscribed and let your friends know. I think if you've been following along and know folks that are planning on binging Disco once all the episodes are out, it would be really awesome for us if you recommended our show to them, because you know we need all the listeners we can get to support this damn thing.
It's the truth.
Well, Adam, I think we can leave it there, and Rob can take it away from here.
The Greatest Discovery is a MaximumFun.org podcast hosted by Adam Pranica and Benjamin R. Harrison, and produced and edited by Rob Schulte. Music by Adam Ragusea. Head to MaximumFun.org to support the ongoing production of this show. Please use the hashtag GreatestGen when discussing the show on Twitter. You can find Ben on Twitter at BenjaminAHR, and Adam is at CutForTime. And make sure to check out the Greatest Gen Reddit and Facebook groups if you're looking to continue the conversation even further.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture. Artist owned.
Listener supported.